This is Audible.
The Rapture by Claire McGlasson, read by Imogen Wilde. Bedford, England, 1926. A vicar's widow called Mabel believes herself to be Octavia, the daughter of God, a messiah with the power to bring an end to suffering in the world. For 6 years she has been gathering followers who flock to live with her in Bedford. They call themselves the Panacea Society. The Great War has claimed their husbands, brothers, and sons, but God has told them that women will bring salvation, a panacea for all disease and despair. The answer lies in a mysterious box sealed by prophetess Joanna Southcott more than a century earlier. But to open it, they must persuade the Church of Men to recognize the rule of women. The following is a work of fiction based on real events. Excerpts from the correspondence or published works held in the Panacea Society archive, which spans almost 100 years, are quoted throughout the book. Passages of scripture are taken from various Bible versions used during this time, some of which were paraphrased or reinterpreted by members. Wouldn't a hostel, a land of Goshen, be lovely? Really devoted believers could take up nice homes in Bedford, which is a most lovely place and is going up by leaps and bounds. Selfridges is coming and has taken a huge block in High Street. Octavia, 1919. The Prayer of St. Ignatius. Make what is true the truth to me. Let fuller light appear. All that is evil take from me. All that is doubtful clear. Let not false confidence betray, no foolish fears mislead, but in the straight and narrow way, be thou my guide indeed. Winter. Were it required of me to emblazon a legend over the gates and doors of these buildings, one which set forth fact and not fiction, it might run thus. Leave self behind, all who enter here. This is the house of correction. This is the era of reproof. Octavia, the cleansing of the sanctuary. Winged messenger. A devil has flown in through her bedroom window. That was her first thought. His eyes were black glass, as dark and deep as Lucifer's soul. It was very surprising, I can assure you, to see his little head parting the lace curtains and looking into the room, Octavia tells us over breakfast. But now she thinks of it, she remembers seeing him yesterday, sitting atop the high wall that keeps us safe inside the garden. He had stayed for nigh on half an hour, watching as we took tea and waited patiently for Jesus. Octavia looks flustered. The string of pearls which always decorates her neck is absent. Her hairstyle has fallen a little short of perfection, and she is late. A very unusual occurrence. Octavia is never late. If a chiming clock dares to accuse her, she is quick to enter a countercharge. It is running fast, or the congregation has gathered too early. Have you no more pressing purpose than to sit here gossiping? But this morning, I sat in silence with Emily and Peter for a full 20 minutes before she joined us at the table. That is, I was silent, and they compared notes, listing the transgressions they had witnessed in others, each sin recorded neatly in their pocketbooks, ready to be shared with Octavia when they are called to give evidence every fortnight. We must all keep an inventory of each other's failings and our own. How else will we improve ourselves in time to receive the Lord? I'm certain my name is on their charge sheet. Dillis Baltrop, underlined above a long list of inadequacies and oversights. But I didn't get the opportunity to find out. Octavia interrupted without apology and began her story without delay. She had been dressing when she saw a large bird sitting on her windowsill. Her first impulse was to cover herself. Perhaps it had come to spy on her nakedness. Devils can disguise themselves in many forms, and of course its black plumage made me suspect it at once, she says, her teacup trembling as she lifts it from the saucer. I think of feathers, beak and claws. I think of Octavia's exposed skin.
"Oh, how terrible!" Peter gasps. "You should have called out. I would have come to your aid."
But the very idea is topsy-turvy. Octavia doesn't need to be saved. She is the one saving us.
"Thank you, Peter," she says with an indulgent smile. "But it should be obvious that this was a creature of God. In the next second, I could see very clearly what it meant."
"A messenger," Emily says theatrically, bringing a hand to the faded lace collar on her throat.
"A winged messenger of heaven."
It's a line from Romeo and Juliet, if I'm not mistaken. Octavia loves it when Emily quotes the bard. It's proof she has succeeded in moulding her, improving her. God made man in his own image. And Octavia is doing the same with Emily. She knew nothing of Shakespeare before she came to us, found God, and joined the middle classes.
"Emily, I knew you would be the one to see it,"
she says, stroking back a strand of grey that has fallen from her chignon. She repositions a hairpin with sufficient force to punish its laxity.
"When I looked into its eyes, God's purpose was obvious. I sprinkled some crumbs of biscuit just below the window, and suddenly he jumped into the room."
She is becoming agitated, excited, eager for us to see the significance of what has happened. And Emily, as usual, is keen to oblige.
"No mortal bird would be so tame. He sat quite happily indoors," she asks.
Octavia laughs.
"I should say so. He took a bath in my basin, did his business on the top of my looking-glass, and after a contented squawk to tell me that the rooms would suit, he went to sleep on one leg."
Octavia names him Sir Jackdaw and tells us something strange and significant has happened.
"It is proof," she says, "a sign that Christ shall soon fly down to us, just as the Lord has promised."
She is convinced that a message has arrived in the garden, that God himself has posted it through her window. I must believe it too. Pond skater. They are watching. I must concentrate on walking, one foot in front of the other, down the length of Albany Road. Head up, back straight like I'm wearing a corset, though Octavia doesn't believe we should wear them. We should have the faith and discipline to contain ourselves. Using whale bones would be cheating. It is not as if I'm doing anything I shouldn't. Walks are permitted in Octavia's list of wholesome exercises for body and soul. But my thoughts might betray me. The devil plants doubts in my head and guilty looks on my face, and that is what they will be looking out for. 58 believers live around the garden now, all chasing the same prize, the glittering treasure of a sin or scandal they can unearth and present to Octavia. Today is the Sabbath, so all work is suspended, except the most important job of all, which is to keep an eye on each other's souls and report back where we find them lacking. Behind those net curtains there will be pocketbooks open, pencils poised. Sunday, 1:38 p.m. Still is seen leaving 12 Albany Road, looking furtive. Octavia calls it overcoming. She tells us Jesus will not return unless we are colourless, faultless, zero. So we must evaluate one another. It is for our own good. She says secrets are like splinters. They need to be wheedled out before they start to fester. But it is not that simple. Some are far too deep. They burrow into flesh. The skin heals over. The stab of pain is gone. And in time you wonder whether they were ever there at all. Those are the secrets that I keep. Secrets from before the others came. Secrets in the box at the back of my wardrobe. I walk past their windows. Past Mary Massey on this side of the street and Mary Beadle on the other. past Florence, Hilda and Agnes at number 19, three sisters who plainly cannot stand the sight of one another and spend their days picking over old squabbles like vultures over bones. Then on past Ethel and Mildred Keeley, whom I find almost impossible to tell apart, and their lodger, whose name I can't remember. I lose track of who they are or how they came to be here. At 25 years old, I am the youngest by at least 2 decades, a peculiarity among the band of increasingly indistinguishable middle-aged ladies, the colour receding from their hair and the definition from their waists. Even the houses look the same, terraced like their occupants, joined together. One may have a little stained glass in the front door, another fretwork like lace along the eaves, or a checkerboard of black and white tiles leading callers up the path. But these are just details. Stand back and they become a single row. They rely on each other to stay standing. If one brick came loose, everything could come crashing down. But they stand firm. Stand guard. And so must we. We're almost all women here. Only a handful of men have been allowed to join. Edgar Pysart, whom God sent as an emissary from America, and Peter, who came to us from Australia. Though whether he really is a man is questionable. A tiny, frail creature, careful never to have an opinion in case it is the wrong one, non-committal even on the question of his own sex. Anything to please Octavia. But I must not have these thoughts. They are not good. Not of God. The devil is whispering again. Doubts and suspicions. Octavia says he pours them down our throats like poison. And a trickle can turn into a torrent. Then sooner or later you drown in his lies. No. Peter is good and kind. But I was surprised she let him move into number 12 with us. 4 of the bedrooms were already taken, and the 5th in use for nightly meetings. But Peter said he would make a room up in the attic. I think he imagines himself as a guardian angel suspended above Octavia as she sleeps. And as he stands at little more than 5 feet tall, the sloping ceilings haven't proved to be much of a problem. Emily came to number 12 as a maid, 2 years ago, but the Lord revealed that he had bigger plans for her than making meals and washing sheets, so Octavia advertised for domestic help, and Betty moved into the box room last year. She is not a member, but she understands the need to follow Octavia's commands without question or complaint, if she wants to keep her job. The others live in neighbouring properties. Those with the means to take their pick of houses made offers too generous to be refused. Ellen Oliver bought the 4-bedroomed house to the left of us, Rachel Fox the one on the right. On it went until Octavia had followers on all sides. She called the first of them apostles, but soon they numbered more than 12. Word spread. Women came to hear her speak, and once they heard her voice, they knew the truth. So they stayed and took their place in the society, as landladies or as lodgers. House after house along Albany Road, Castle Street, Newnham Road and the Embankment. 4 roads that meet to form a square like soldiers in formation. Where they do break ranks, there's a high wall that runs between them. So we are completely enclosed. Safe. Contained. And inside the boundary lies paradise. We thought Octavia was speaking figuratively when she told us that. But she wasn't. This is the Garden of Eden, hidden in plain sight. It was here in Bedford all along. Those who came later had to make do with houses several streets away. Messengers rushed between them to share her word. Typists like me put it down on paper. Those in the printing room make copies to be sent all over the world. Some of the ladies scour the papers for signs that the end times are upon us. Hurricanes in the tropics or earthquakes in Italy. Then there are letters to be written and healing to be administered. And the tea and cake is not going to serve itself. I see their relief when they hurry past with an envelope in their hand, raising it as proof that they cannot possibly stop and chat to me.
I must catch the last post, they call back over their shoulder. No rest for the wicked!
If they asked me how I am, there's a risk I might answer truthfully. Besides, there are rules about what we're allowed to say out loud. Limit all dialogue to pleasantries and practicalities. Do not question. Only obey. I have left the house in too light a coat, the mouse-grey velvet that was hanging in the hallway. I hadn't planned to walk, but I had to get out, away from the whispered judgments and scribbled accusations. But even here I am not free of them. On the other side of the street I see a familiar figure. It is the top hat that gives him away, as much a part of his silhouette as the gold-topped cane he carries. Edgar Pysart touches a gloved hand to the brim to acknowledge that he has seen me, but he does not slow his pace, perhaps as much in need of solitude as I. At the bottom of Albany Road, the grey sky opens and meets its own reflection on the River Great Ouse, a ribbon of water as wide as the road that runs beside it. A crew of schoolboys rows by, gliding in a mist of frozen breath, their blades moving together like the legs of a giant insect. A pond skater. That's what they look like. Edgar says that in America they call them Jesus bugs because they walk on water, unaware that they are performing a miracle. The river is so close I could touch it. Dip my toe in first, then wade in after. There are no walls or sloping banks to stop me. There is nothing to stop me except the cold. When spring comes, I shall sit at the water's edge and watch the twigs and blossoms that it carries to the distant sea. Then in summer, the spectacle of day-trippers out on punts. A splash, a shot of laughter, another young man boasting, cocksure and trying to impress. I will see him panicking as the punt pole gets stuck in the mud. Sometimes we cling to the very thing that is pulling us under. There's a couple on the path ahead. From the way she turns her head to his, I suppose they must be sweethearts. He is walking on crutches, an empty trouser leg hanging limply as he moves. I cross the street and turn up Newnham Road away from them. I don't want him to meet my eyes and see what I am thinking, imagining how he looks beneath his clothes, pale skin puckered like fingertips that have been too long in the bathwater. I picture him lying in no man's land, his torn flesh, the smell of earth and iron as he bled into the wool of his uniform. When we got the news that the war was over, I half expected that the lost limbs would grow back, that the fallen would rise. But 7 years have passed and none of my brothers have returned home. Ivan moved to Canada, Adrian went to India, and Eric is in France. Well, his body is, but not his soul. That has gone to heaven.
Pilgrim's Progress. Perhaps it was the thought of my brothers that brought me here. We used to play in the gardens of the Bunyan Meeting Church. The boys took turns with a spinning top, and I would make do with a single pebble, tossing it onto the path, playing hopscotch on the paving stones that carve a walkway between the sparsely filled flower beds. It is one of those January days where the air hangs perfectly still, where no breeze shakes the bones of the trees, a day when it feels that time itself is frozen. I can hear the hymns we used to sing when I was young. We'd walk into church together, my brothers first, me following behind. I was the youngest and the only girl, two frailties that induced their affectionate contempt. Would it be wrong to go inside and sit with my memories of them for a while, to remember the days when we'd sit and listen to Father preach to his flock? The church is made of red brick. It is sturdy, practical, unremarkable. Like most men, that's what Octavia would say. But inside it opens into a palace of pale light, coloured glass scattering rainbows onto the canvas of muted walls. Everything is made of wood, every surface painted in pastel shades of contemplation, warming from the purest white of snowdrops to the butter yellow of daffodils. I take a seat at the back,
When I get home, I can tell Octavia I wandered into church to witness the folly of men, to hear them spill the Lord's words carelessly like drunks. I can say I came to spy on their ignorance and remember how lucky I am to know the truth.
Let us pray.
The minister begins to speak and I bow my head, opening one eye just a little to study the embroidery on the kneeling cushions. Hundreds of little crosses standing in line, like the sufferings of men. How quickly they blur once I open the other eye, a white dove and the word faith coming sharply into view.
Another hymn. Please join me in singing number 402, He Who Would Valiant Be.
The minister's voice brings the congregation to its feet. No one bows their head to read their hymn books. Every word is committed to memory. This is their battle cry. John Bunyan's words sung in the very church he established. He is Bedford's most famous son, a bronze statue standing on St. Peter's Green. But all that will be forgotten when God reveals that he has sent his own daughter to live among us here. Octavia's glory will outshine them all. Sometimes I imagine her as a statue carved from white marble. She'd never stand for anything less, and she would have to be standing. I see her high on a plinth, her sturdy shoulders hewn from rock, a long skirt falling like a curtain to the floor, disembodied from the waist down, standing perfectly still with her eyes raised to heaven. Unshakable. Immovable. I am silent. My lips are moving but forming no sounds. I study the congregation, an anthropologist recording their primitive beliefs. Childish, reassuring and familiar. They sing on without me, voices rising to meet the stained glass windows that turn their words to pictures, Bunyan's allegories painted in sunlight. I study the depiction of his hero Christian, dressed in knight's armour, slaying the fiend Apollyon. How I envy the violent simplicity of his task, the chance to prove his devotion, to step into battle with the promise of salvation, win or lose. It is the privilege of man, but I am a woman. No great war or great coat, no glory. My test is endurance, patience. Constancy. All I can do is wait for a sign that God has a purpose for me too, a chance to prove myself to him and to Octavia. After the final verse, the minister concludes the service, sending the congregation on its way with a blessing. They stand and button up their coats, fix their hats and gloves. But I am in no rush to get home. It has always been my favourite, says a voice beside me. There's a woman sitting a little further along the pew. Octavia would say she's barely more than a girl, but she is probably only a year or two younger than I am, in her early 20s, perhaps. On her lips she wears a smile, of apology or perhaps amusement. The window, she gestures with her head. I saw you studying it. St. George slaying the dragon. It's always been my favourite. I think it's the drama of it. It's not a dragon, I say, surprised at how blunt and distant my words sound. I'm not used to strangers, but I mustn't be rude. She is only making polite conversation. That is what people do. Other people. I'm sorry, I say. What I mean is, it looks like a dragon, but look closely, and you can just see. Small lines appear on her forehead as she exaggerates her expression, narrowing her eyes and lifting her hand above her brows, an impression of a sailor looking out to sea. She is trying to make me smile, and it works. The scales of a fish, I say, the wings of a dragon and the mouth of a lion. It is a demon. I stop there. I don't tell her the differences that dragons are mythical creatures and demons are real. I don't say that Octavia has seen Apollyon from her window, or that he waits for her to leave the safety of the garden so he can devour her. If she ventures more than 77 steps outside, she will be taken. God was very clear when he told her that, so she has not crossed the front doorstep in 8 years. I don't say any of this out loud to the woman beside me. It would be too much for a non-believer to understand, so I say nothing at all. Instead, we sit together in the companionship of silence, and I watch her at the edge of my vision. A blur on the corner of a page, the margins of a watercolour hidden beneath the frame. Pale skin, auburn hair pulled back loosely from her face.
"I haven't seen you here before," she says.
"No, I haven't been. Not for a long time. But I was walking by, I heard the hymn and it brought back memories.
Good ones, I hope."
I answer her question with a smile, but I don't move my eyes from the window. I wonder why she is talking to me, whether she knows who I am and where I live. Is there something about me that makes it obvious I don't belong here?
"I haven't been for a while either," she says.
"Oh?
I don't have a church as such. One week I go to chapel, the next I might be at Catholic Mass."
She pauses, and I know I am expected to fill the silence. She wants me to ask her why. I should make my excuses and leave. I mustn't ask questions, because then she will ask them of me. But I can't help myself.
"Why?
Why do you go from one church to the next?"
"I don't know. I'm something of a seeker. Still searching."
"For God?"
"I suppose so, yes."
She laughs and shakes her head.
"Here we are, discussing theology, and I haven't even introduced myself. I'm Grace Hardwick. Do you live nearby?"
Here they come, the questions. I've brought this on myself. But I can do this. I can spread the word, just like the others do.
"I'm Dilys Baltrop, pleased to meet you."
"Yes, very close. One street away, Albany Road."
"Albany, isn't that where..."
I hear words swallowed down. A moment's pause before she speaks again.
"The religious group of women."
"The Panacea Society."
"Yes, that's it. Are you... I mean to say, is that where you live?"
"It is." I prepare myself for her insults, or perhaps she will simply stand and walk away in silence. But she does neither. Instead, she shifts along the pew to sit right beside me.
"How exciting," she says, which is the last thing I expected. "I have always wondered, a society of women, how many of you are there?"
I look down at the cuffs of my sleeves, stroking down the nap of the felt. "We have almost 60 resident members," I say, "and half as many again who live in other parts of Bedford. Mostly women, but we do have a small number of men." Now I am wishing I had brought one of our pamphlets with everything written down. If it is left to me, I'll probably get it wrong. She makes a noise, somewhere between a laugh and a sigh. Octavia always says that non-believers only want to mock and humiliate us. But Miss Hardwick seems fascinated. I am a source of fascination.
"You must tell me everything," she says.
But I could never do that. There are things that I must never say out loud, even in the society. Especially in the society.
"Well, there is a lot to tell. I'm not sure what you have heard about our work, the Lord's work. Great change is coming, and it is us women, who will usher it in. Given the chance, I would tear this world up entirely and start afresh," she says.
"The time is near. Our time." I risk a glance up to her face. "Perhaps you should come and pay us a visit. I could show you the stained glass window in our chapel, if you'd like to see it."
"I would," she replies. "Very much. But oh, we better go. The rest of the congregation have left.
There's a lively rhythm to her voice. Her vowels unfurl like stretching limbs, but there's a tension, as if she is trying to fold them back into sharper angles. As if she can't quite be contained. We step outside and she retreats into her coat. Dark blue wool, the colour of the night where it meets the horizon. A button is hanging loose on her cuff, small and dark to match the fabric. It is one of a line of 10, each paired with a loop, but this one is breaking free.
"You look terribly cold," she says, reaching out to touch my arm.
Some people are like that, so comfortable in their own skin that they think nothing of sharing themselves, unaware of the power or threat of their bodies. I shrink back and she hides her hand in her pocket, the loose button swinging as her arm grows still. Then, very slowly, her eyes find mine. She is holding me with her gaze. I am being held.
"So should I come?" she asks softly.
"Of course," I say a little too brightly. "You must come. Next Sunday at 3.
I'll see you then. Which house?"
"Oh yes, it's number 12. Grace turns and walks into the last of the afternoon. Her button is lying near to my feet and I pick it up and put it in my pocket. "Next Sunday at 3. How will I explain this to Octavia? What have I done?
Ugly ways.
"You look much brighter in the eyes. Your little outing yesterday did you good, Dillis."
With Emily, it is always a statement, never a question.
"But next time, I think it would be prudent to wear a more suitable coat."
I don't respond. It is the only power I have. She wants me to know that she saw me leaving the house, that nothing is beyond her reach. We both understand she would prefer it if I was out of the way, out of the picture, so she could paint herself at the centre of the scene, at Octavia's right hand. She is becoming more like her every day, or trying to. Both wear their hair piled high in styles that were fashionable 20 years ago, pompadours that make their heads resemble cottage loaves. Both wear the same high-necked dresses. Octavia's hemlines have retreated to no more than an inch above her ankles, stubbornly refusing to accept that Queen Victoria is no longer on the throne, or that values have changed outside the walls of the garden. That's why good manners are so important in here. That's why Octavia insists we call a napkin, never a serviette. That's why R11s have been served on a mahogany stand, a rich fruit cake cut to fill 3 tiers with identical slices. Though we know without being told that we must not take a piece, that we must choose a tea cake from the plate instead. The fruit loaf will return to the kitchen to be brought out as a decoration again tomorrow.
"Well, it is lovely to see you looking so well."
Emily's words are like a trail of breadcrumbs, and Octavia follows.
"You went out yesterday, Dillis?" she asks.
"Yes, Octavia, just for a walk along the river." I should tell her I went to church. I reach for a tea cake. I need time to calm my breathing and gain control.
"Was it pleasant?" she asks.
I'm sorry. She looks to Emily with an eyebrow raised, then turns back to address me.
"Your walk, Dillis," she sighs. "Was it pleasant?"
"Yes, thank you, Octavia." I should tell her that I went to church. I should tell her in case anyone saw me. She turns her attention to a copy of the Telegraph while Emily refills her cup, and in the interval of silence, it is already too late to confess.
"Dreadful," she says without lifting her eyes from the newspaper. "News of another earthquake in Italy."
She turns the page, scouring the columns for more evidence of disaster, plague or pestilence, signs that the end times are upon us. I didn't actually tell a lie.
If she had asked me outright, I would have admitted I went to church. I'm almost certain of it. I saw Edgar while I was walking, I say, filling my mouth with other words so the truth won't come spilling out. He was out for a stroll too.
No, says Emily, relishing the chance to take control of the conversation. He was on his way to the station to meet Donald from the train. That young man seems to be spending more time here than he does in Cambridge. I'm not quite sure how these students get away with so little work.
She pauses to see if Octavia is listening, but her attention is still focused on the headlines.
I shouldn't wonder that he'll ask to move here permanently once the summer comes. It is heartening to see youngsters coming into the fold, isn't it?
As it happens, I met someone yesterday, I say. A Miss Hardwick.
Who?
Says Octavia, folding her newspaper and tossing it aside, as if satisfied that the reality of life has lived up to her worst fears. A young lady called Miss Hardwick. She wishes to know about us. About the society. I thought we might invite her to pay us a visit.
I don't tell Octavia that I've invited her already.
What do you think?
I think we had better ask the Lord, she says. Let us pray.
I bow my head and shut my eyes tight. My heartbeat starts to slow, a feeling of calm climbing up my legs and into my stomach, turning like a cat about to settle for a nap. I know that Octavia will say yes, but not because I have asked her, because God has. For the first time in a long time, I feel he is listening to my prayer. Octavia clears her throat and I look up.
Very well, she says. Do you have her address?
I don't, but I nod.
Then send word. Invite her to come.
I try not to show my relief, but I drop my guard, becoming slovenly, and within minutes Octavia clatters out of the room with the wild look that makes me think of doctors and locked doors. I was eating my tea cake too loudly. The scraping of the knife as I spread the butter, the crunch as I took my first bite. Perhaps it is the carnality that offends her, the sounds of the body taking pleasure, the jaw, the teeth, the throat. Perhaps it reminds her that we are flesh and blood after all. Octavia leaves in such a hurry she almost knocks into Peter, who has just arrived to join us at the table.
I'm sorry. Please excuse me. My fault entirely. I should not have been late.
He'll be stewing on this all afternoon now. In his eyes, he is always the one to blame. And deep down, I think he is always sorry for the same offence. As an Australian citizen, he could have signed up to face death with our boys in France. But to his eternal shame, he chose to live instead.
Octavia, are you all right?
He calls after her, but she doesn't answer. She is already in the hallway, already climbing the stairs to her bedroom. Peter looks to Emily for explanation.
What happened? He asks, patting the crown of his head as though taming his unruly hair will calm his nerves.
The natural curls fall into ridges across his scalp, the ends so frizzy they look as though they have been waved with irons left too long in the fire. It was me, I say. It was my fault. A tea cake. I am selfish and I am thoughtless. Too big, too loud, too irritating. I forgot the rules and I nearly spoiled it. If I had taken that bite when I asked Octavia about Miss Hardwick, she might have said she couldn't come. I must make myself smaller, quieter.
The things that make it difficult to live peaceably with a person are the things that must be altered. They are worse than sin because they make other people sin.
I know God will admonish me tonight. I know just how it will go. At 5 p.m, Octavia will sit at the desk in her bedroom, lifting the pen to receive his word, her body stiffening as his spirit enters her. At 5:30 p.m, she will be holding a piece of paper written in a hand that is not her own. Heavy splashes of ink beside the scratch of a nib too faint to read, where the words have poured out too quickly. At 6 p.m, we shall gather in the chapel to hear his daily message.
Octavia will begin, as she always does, reminding us that we are the chosen ones. Eve ate from the tree. We, her daughters, must be the ones to heal the rift with God. Motherly encouragement, which in the next breath turns to discipline. All ugly noises and ugly ways of eating tend to make people unpopular, however good they are. It may be very pleasant to exercise good teeth in this way, but it will not be tolerated here. She will not say my name, but I will know she is talking about me. And so will Emily, who will take out her pencil and pocketbook and add it to the ledger of my faults. Disciples. My father came to visit me again last night while I was sleeping. I was 8 years old when he died. It's difficult to know whether my memories really are my own, or planted by someone else, like a cuckoo's eggs. Now they have hatched and my dreams of him are so vivid they've become the truth. An idea starts like a spiral of smoke, but if it's persuasive enough it takes shape, forms sharp edges, becomes solid. When I see him, he is always standing behind a lectern, an eagle made of gold. He is looking out at his congregation, his eyes moving across the rows of faces, trying to find just one. Lifting his arms, he starts to speak, but the words won't come out. He drops to the floor, and all I can see are the bottoms of his legs, twitching, jerking, jumping. One of his turns. We never knew when they would happen or when he would wake up. Then one day he didn't. I wonder what he would have made of the Panacea Society, whether he would have been a believer or have covered his ears before the truth could persuade him. What would he have made of the chapel I sit in now, in the garden? It is everything the Bunyan Meeting Church is not. Small, dark, domestic. God's drawing room. Octavia calls it cozy. You can see her influence in every detail. The ladder-backed chairs, the Persian rugs, the arrangements of artificial flowers, silk roses blushing beneath a layer of dust, velvet leaves faded to carmine by the passing of years. Wood panels line the walls of the chancel, which is furnished entirely from Liberty's homeware department. A fluted console table serves as an altar, framed by twisted brass candlesticks that stand on narrow shelves at either side. The lectern is a tall plant stand, its legs cut into cusped arches like church windows. From behind it, Octavia delivers the Eucharist. She has a handkerchief draped over her head, embroidered with a dove and an olive branch. She wears a red priest's stole, vestments only ever meant to house a man's form, pulling tightly across her bosom. And there's a scarf around her neck, a paisley of dark blues and greens, tassels printed around the edges to make it look like a shawl. Octavia does not approve of calling out or speaking in tongues, not if it interrupts her sermons. But I can hear someone whispering, the same words over and over again like the hiss of a train's pistons, picking up speed, pushing on towards heaven. Others raise a hand above their heads, eyes closed in rapture, like children reaching up to catch drops of summer rain. And occasionally someone will swoon or fall to their knees. All these are signs that they are receiving the Holy Spirit. I am never one of those people. The chapel is too small for us to take communion at the altar. We sit in pairs either side of a narrow aisle, passing a tray of bread between us. Octavia insists the sacramental loaves are baked each morning. She doesn't hold with the idea of wafers, which means we have to be careful of crumbs. We recite the liturgy. May I drink deep into the Spirit of Christ, and may his blood cleanse me from all sin. But we don't drink wine, not when we have a true miracle on tap. A communion chalice is passed between us and we take a sip of the water, infused with the healing power of Octavia's breath. Christ's death on the cross, his atoning for sin, has saved our souls, but still we suffer such terrible trials in this life. Another Redeemer is required for the body." Octavia is reading aloud the words she has received from God through her pen this evening. "There was a second Adam, Jesus, to reverse the sins of man. Now I come as the second Eve. I must suffer for the sins of women." "Amen," the cries are loudest from the front rows where Octavia's favourites sit. I am never invited to take a seat there, but at least from the back I have a view of the entire congregation. From here I can watch them and collect their faults. If I am lucky, someone might yawn when Octavia is speaking, or whisper to their neighbour when they should be bowing their head to pray. I will jot down these transgressions in my pocketbook after chapel, ready to present to Octavia when I am called to her sitting room to make my report. But I already know I will be found lacking, that she will say I am not committed to the overcoming, to cleansing the society of sin. I suspect some of the others make things up, but I can never quite bring myself to do it. Perhaps I lack imagination. Besides, you have to think carefully before shining a light on other people's lives, because the glare can reflect back on you, illuminate your faults for all to see. Today the only person yawning is Ellen Oliver, and I could never write her name in my book. She is the oldest among us. She turned 60 a few years ago, though we didn't celebrate. We don't have time for such worldly concerns. I've noticed lately that she is looking frail, fainter, as if the lines of her face and body have been smudged, a poorly sketched portrait of the fearless woman I have always admired. It was Ellen who realised that the Messiah she had been looking for was sitting beside her in prayer group, who realised that her friend Mabel was elevated, augmented, divine. When the others came to see the truth, they called her Octavia, the eighth in a line of prophets. But it was Ellen who deciphered the signs. She can see what others can't. She always sees the best in people. Even in me. Octavia steps behind the curtain into the small room to the side of the altar and returns with a bowl of water, the corner of a towel tucked into a loop of her belt. "Be kind enough to open that for me," she says, passing a block of soap to Emily, who is sitting on the front row. It must be sunlight, or Lux. God has told her that those are the only brands to trust, so she insists that no one buys or uses any other. "I had intended to have everything ready, but the Lord had so much to say this evening," she says. "When I woke from my trance, I was amazed to see how many pages I had written." She holds out her hand for the soap, but Emily is still struggling with the wrapping. "Just as Christ washed the feet of his disciples, so the Lord has bade me do the same. Oh, give it to me, Emily, I'll do it myself." With a jerk of her head, she directs Emily to go behind the curtain and prepare herself. "Since God is fourfold, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and daughter, so the four of you are the chosen." We all know who she is talking about, the front rowers, the ones she meets with in private after chapel, Peter, Edgar, Kate Firth, and Emily, who emerges now from behind the curtain. She looks uneasy, her shoulders hunched. One hand is curled around a ball of rolled-up viscous stockings, which she has dusted with talcum powder to dull their cheap shine. The fingers of her other hand are hooked inside the backs of her shoes. She is exposed, presenting the worn soles to the congregation, revealing the metal tacks and offcuts of leather hammered in to patch the holes. Even her naked legs look threadbare, greyish with chalky patches of dry skin and flecks of dark hair. "Please sit." Octavia directs her to the small pew to the left of the altar, and kneels slowly. Peter jumps to his feet to slip a cushion underneath Octavia's knee before it reaches the ground, attentive as always, terrified that he might miss an opportunity to serve. Emily stifles a shudder as Octavia submerges her feet into the water. "You came to us at least to give, but most to offer, Octavia says. You didn't have the advantages the rest of us have enjoyed. But you have faith, Emily, and you are obedient. Those are the things the Lord values above all. She continues with a good lather and scrub, apparently unperturbed by Emily's numerous corns and bunions. But then, she could hardly balk at a little dry skin when Jesus washed a leper. With her feet patted dry, Emily nods her head in thanks and gives up her seat to Kate Firth, who appears from behind the curtain, holding a pair of burgundy shoes and silk stockings. "Yes, it's a lesson you have had to learn, isn't it, Kate?" Octavia says. "Our very own Doubting Thomas." Kate sits down and arranges the fine pleats on the gathered lapel that runs down her front. Her dress, drop-waisted crepe in the exact shade of her shoes, is yet another that I haven't seen her wear before. "You doubted the Lord's calling," Octavia says. "You doubted me. You wanted to be sure that we were not deceived, which was admirable. But men are blinded by reason, and look where it has got them. Women should follow their hearts, which is where the Lord dwells. That's why he has chosen us to do his bidding. We must all remember that." Kate was here at the beginning, before the beginning, when Octavia was Mabel. And of the two of them, Kate was considered the more extraordinary, a fine-looking widow who moved to Bedford from York, bringing her northern accent and two servants with her. She and Mabel would chat over the wall between their gardens, or take turns to have the other round for tea, sharing cake and letters from the front line, sharing each other's despair when the telegrams arrived, with no idea that one of them would soon be revealed as the daughter of God to restore the hope that war had stolen away. "I forgive you," Octavia says. "The Lord forgives you. You were always generous in spirit, and since you came to see the truth, you have been generous indeed, too, opening the haven, your own home, to the believers who have flocked to Bedford." I am becoming restless. I wonder what Grace Hardwick is doing right now, and what she would think of our service. If she comes, Octavia will see that I have been working for the glory of the Lord. Sometimes I daydream that Grace will stand up and tell the congregation that as soon as we met she felt God's calling, that she felt his power in me. That would surprise them. It is Peter's turn. Octavia takes the first of his feet in her hands without a word, creating a void of silence for his gratitude to fill. "Octavia, I cannot let you do it," he says. But his grave expression is undermined by the airy Australian accent, which makes even the most resolute statement sound like a tentative apology. "Octavia," his tone is almost pleading now, "let me be the one to bathe you." Octavia is gratified by his humble attitude, but I suspect, by the way he holds on to the sides of his seat, that it is motivated by ticklish feet more than deference on this occasion. "Hush now," she says firmly. In him she has found the son she always wanted. Obedient, adoring, present. Though there are very few years that separate them, Peter in his early 50s and Octavia in her late, he has finally found purpose in his life and plays the part of devoted child with utter conviction. He is juvenile even in appearance. There is always too much tie hanging beneath the knot at his neck, or too little, and his trousers bunch above his shoes as though he might one day grow into them. His neck looks barely able to hold up a head so heavy with curly hair, a protuberant Adam's apple quivering and bobbing beneath a face that seems to be perpetually cast down towards the floor. Octavia rubs soap onto his feet, lather foaming on the clumps of hairs that sprout from his toes. I find the sight of his pale skin distasteful. Feet are always covered, shrouded in socks or shoes or slippers. And though I can't see there's anything about Peter's feet that would lead anyone to sin, Just the act of looking feels improper. I see his relief when the washing is over and he no longer has to fight the impulse to laugh or the reflex to kick her away. Neither would help to create the impression that he is taking this ceremony seriously.
Peter, you are an example to us all.
Octavia looks up to the congregation to make her meaning clear. An example to those who think they should be chosen. Those who were here before Peter came along, and long before Edgar Pysart arrived. It is his turn now.
Edgar,
Octavia says, taking a moment to line up the pair of two-tone Oxfords that he was wearing, black toes side by side, white bars perfectly aligned. She takes each hem of his trousers and rolls it up to just below the knee, exposing scarlet socks held up by garters.
Really, Edgar, she says, averting her eyes as though finding the sight of them painful. What a garish colour.
They are considered rather fashionable in America, he says without apology.
They may be considered fashionable in America, but here in England they are considered vulgar.
He says nothing more and leans down to take them off, bending forward and revealing a thin patch in his white hair. He is a dandy, an old man dressed as a young one. He always wears an air of youthful detachment, but his face betrays his age, eyes so deep set that they are in perpetual shadow, and lips that turn down at the corners even when he smiles. When Kate Firth first saw him, she said he looked like the devil himself, but I've always imagined Satan would be handsome and charming and young. After all, he can take any shape he pleases, and beautiful people always get away with more.
We women have been instructed not to listen to the opinions of any man, lest we should be led astray, Octavia says, nodding for him to put his feet into the water. But let no one be in any doubt that you are here as a follower, not as a teacher. You bow to the rule of woman. You serve faithfully. Let that not be questioned by anyone in the garden.
Has she heard the whispered conversations? There are those who think Edgar should not be favoured. He's a man, and an American. What is she thinking? But Edgar is nothing if not persistent. He started writing to her last year, asking for her blessing to move to England and join the society. He wouldn't give up until she gave in. But we were all surprised when she relented. Octavia is not a person who concedes. She doesn't have to. She has the certainty of God's blessing in everything.
Indeed, Octavia, he says, I am your servant, sent by God to represent man's place in the new world. He turns his head to the congregation. For God has a role for all of us.
And that role, says Octavia, jerking his feet out of the water, is to serve, not to seek your own glories. Pride leads to a fall, Edgar.
She does not dry him, but